Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Cinnamon, where you gonna run to?
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Virtuoso pianist and powerful, passionate singer Nina Simone burned bright, almost burned out. Her voice whispered love into thousands of ears, wrote Maya Angelou, and revolution into the hearts of millions. She fought for black rights, black power. She fought her own demons. A new documentary brings it all back, just as Charleston and more make her story urgent again. This hour on Point, reliving Nina Simone. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Why is Nina Simone hot again? Sampled by Kanye and Jay-Z, covered by Mary J. Blige, Usher. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Behind us, Cinnerman. Nina Simone originally recorded this African-American traditional spiritual for her 1965 album, Pastel Blues. Cinnerman, what are you going to do? Joining us now from New York is Liz Garbus, Oscar-nominated director known for Killing in the Name and Bobby Fischer Against the World, among other great documentaries. Her latest documentary is What's Happened, Miss Simone. It's out on Netflix this Friday. Also opens in theaters in New York today, in Los Angeles on Friday. You can find a trailer at our website, onpointradio.org. Liz Garbus, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to have you here. We heard you on Morning Edition on NPR. Manola Dargis, writing about your documentary, calls it electric, bracingly urgent. And I think there are no two ways about that. The news in Charleston has really brought this story and the passions that Nina Simone wrestled with, that the whole country had to deal with, right back front and center. Tragic as it is, it makes the story you're telling somehow more urgent than ever, does it not, Liz?
Well, certainly it's on the forefront of people's minds at the moment. You know, I would argue that the problem has been urgent for centuries.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, of course, in the past year since the incidents in Ferguson, we've been awakened to these issues. You know, the technology has allowed police brutality to be seen in all over America. And so people are speaking out again and becoming re-energized. And of course, the massacre in Charleston is tragic, heartbreaking, and reminds us of the Birmingham church bombing, which is what brought Nina Simone to her activism.
There's so much fantastic footage in this documentary. I mean, you can dig back into this era. A lot of it is black and white. A lot of it is not as well. The music is amazing. Even to the very end where she's singing, and I forget where the venue is now. This is very late on. And the classical kind of piano sound under her American standard. She did want to be that classical pianist. She did want to run with Bach. The culture, the country wouldn't let her. It seemed to frustrate her for her whole life.
Yeah, that's right. She was a classically trained pianist at age six. Several white people in the community in Tryon, North Carolina, where she was growing up, saw that they had a prodigy on their hands, and they decided to take up a collection for her musical education. So she studied with a wonderful teacher, Ms. Mazanovich, and Nina fell in love with Bach. And that was the career she envisioned herself, the vision of a career of classical piano. Her dream was to be the first black classical pianist in Carnegie Hall. At a certain point, the money ran out for her education. She was at Juilliard but was denied entry to Curtis. Mm-hmm. And so she had to start playing in bars. And that's when she started singing. It wasn't, you know, this was not the path that she thought she was going to be on.
But she had to make a living. Is it clear from your research for the documentary or in her mind that it was racism that kept her off that path at Curtis when she was denied admission there?
It was clear in her mind. You know, Curtis did have a precedent of accepting other African-American students, but of course they were the vast, vast, vast minority of those who were accepted. And it's hard to imagine that in the 1950s, race did not come into play in any acceptance decision. But whether it was solely that factor, you know, Curtis denies that.
Paint a picture of the personality of Nina Simone. We'll have listeners who know her very well, who will have her on in their homes and beyond all the time, and others for whom your documentary may be an introduction. Give us a sense of the this sprawling, passionate, bright burning, not uncommon, and often angry at certain points. Artist.
That's right. Well, Nina, I think she's many different things to many different people. I mean, for some people, she's a righteous voice of the rebellion, a leader of the movement, and people turn to her as a civil rights leader. For others, she plays smooth tunes that they want to play at their dinner party, like My Baby Just Cares for Me, or an upbeat song like Feeling Good. But I think for all people, you know, what Nina's voice does and her interpretations of songs do is channel something very deep and very emotional, so that kind of no matter where you are, where you've been, you feel that this woman has felt it before and is with you. And that is because of the vast amount of suffering and that Nina did go through in her life. She was a person who had many struggles, both inner and outer, that made her music. She channeled all of that experience into her music.
Her big hit, 1958, was "I Loves You, Porgy." Of course, originally from Porgy and Bess by George Gershwin, 1958 from her album Little Girl Blue. Before all the civil rights action that would come, here's Nina Simone.
I love you, Porgy. Don't let him take me. Don't let him handle me and drive me mad. If you can keep me, I wanna stay here with you forever. And I'll be so glad.
Nina Simone, 1958, with I Loves You, Porgy. It was a hit for her. Like Billie Holiday, she left that S off. Just I love you, not this sort of blackface. I loves you, Porgy.
Right.
What a voice. The depth of that voice throughout her life, even in the hard times, never, to my ear, lost its powerless.
That's right. I mean, and she had so much range. I mean, she described it as, you know, sometimes I sound like coffee and cream. I think here in Porgy we hear that. Sometimes I sound like gravel. You know, you can hear her in songs like Four Women, where she's strange to the edge of her voice. And it's that kind of range, you know, that give this the music this emotional ride.
Though I think it's her daughter at one point in your documentary, What Happened, Miss Simone, says that she was in Selma or Montgomery singing with Dr. King, sang with such when was it? She sang with so much passion that she said she lost some of her range. She sort of blew it out in the passion of the civil rights movement.
That's right. Her daughter says that after she wrote Mississippi Goddamn, which she wrote after the Birmingham church bombing, and, you know, that was really her first engagement with the civil rights movement, at least outwardly, publicly, as a public figure, that her voice dropped an octave. And that that she lost some of her range. I think that she was so angry. That's the way her daughter understood it. That some of those higher, sweeter notes, she couldn't make them anymore. I'm not sure if that's perhaps a daughter's perception, and if she really could, or if it's, you know, it's of course maybe subjective, but I think that there is an emotional, psychological, political truth to it, which is that there was a fierceness and a fight that was inspired in her that would characterize the rest of her career.
That was a fraught relationship. We'll look at that. Having done this documentary, how do you measure the inner and the outer origins of Nina Simone's anger? There was so much artistry, so much beauty, but she could be angry as well, and with plenty of cause. She saw so many killed and talked about it, shouted about it. She saw all the injustice, racial injustice in this country and talked about it, shouted about it, sang about it. But you also make clear that eventually it became clear that she had some bipolar issues going on as well. What are the portions there?
That's right. I mean, I don't know if you can parse it. I think there are a lot of elements to consider. You know, one thing is, you know, she grew up again in the Jim Crow South, but this prodigy kind of held outside of society in this glass box. And, you know, her dream of a classical piano deferred, right? So this is a very sort of unique childhood, hard to survive that childhood being a child prodigy, where the whole community's hopes are on you and you can do nothing but you know, live up to some impossible dream.
There's wonderful footage you have there of the whole, it looks like a sanctuary, a church full of people just worshipfully watching her at, I don't know what, 6, 7, 8 years old, play the piano. Their hopes clearly on her.
And that's a very intense way to grow up. And then, of course, you know, the civil rights movement and the amount, you know, that she gave of herself. She put, you know, she put it, the movement before, you know, her own sanity, before her career, the commercial aspect of her career. Of course, it took her away from her family. Mm-hmm. And then when she had the profound disappointment of the movement not living up to what, you know, that so many hopes that people had for it. And of course, so many leaders being murdered and killed. These were hard events to survive. So if there was a nascent predisposition towards some mental illness, you can certainly see how the circumstances would exacerbate them. You know, James Baldwin wrote, to be a Negro and to be partly conscious in America is to be, you know, in a constant state of rage. And I think that, you know, certainly, you know, that type of rage, the injustice that one sees every single day that we're still seeing today, and then trying to be at the forefront of that, that's an extraordinarily stressful position.
You have Malcolm X's daughter, one of his daughters, Atala Shabazz, Ambassador Shabazz, in the documentary saying, most people are afraid to be as honest as she lived. She, as in Nina Simone. Liz Garbus is with us from New York. Her new Netflix documentary coming out this week is What Happened, Miss Simone. You can find a preview at our website, onpointradio.org. Liz, please stand by there. Salamisha Tillett joins us in a moment. We're talking about jazz virtuoso, fiery protest singer Nina Simone. You can join us. Do you know Nina Simone? Do you know her long and deeply, known her for years, back to her glory, her day? Or do you know her from 5 minutes ago, from hip-hop sampling, from Kanye and Jay-Z and Lauryn Hill's covers? We're at 800-423-8255. Baltimore, her song behind us here. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Nina Simone right there with Mississippi Goddamn. Jaunty sounding melody, presentation there, almost show tune. She wrote it after the Birmingham bombings, the murder of Medgar Evers, in despair and anger, and the lyrics make that clear. That and much more in the new documentary, What Happened, Miss Simone. It's out from Netflix, available this Friday in theaters in New York today, L.A. on Friday. Its director Liz Garbus joins us this hour from New York. Oscar-nominated director of Bobby Fischer Against the World, The Farm, Angola, USA, Before the Spring, much more, Love, Maryland. You can join us this hour. Do you know Nina Simone? Have you known her for a long time? Are you just catching up with her lately? And what do you see in the Nina Simone story, in her artistry, her struggles, her furies? Did she give voice back in the day to your anger? Does she still? Does it change anything? Something that she was probably bipolar for much of her life? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Liz Garbus, tell us about this song, the moment at which it was written, the speed with which it was written, and why this sort of jaunty show tune envelope around such angry social critique.
Nina said, this is a show tune, but they haven't written the show yet.
Yeah.
I think there's some humor there. I mean, I don't know. This song poured out of her in 20 minutes after she learned of the bombing and the killing of 4 children in the Birmingham church. And it started a new phase of her career, a phase where she was writing her own material and, you know, she composed some of the great anthems for the civil rights movement, collaborating with intellectuals, the great artists and intellectuals of the time, like Lorraine Hansberry, with whom she wrote Young, Gifted, and Black. Mm-hmm. Lorraine Hansberry, who wrote Raisin in the Sun, of course.
Mm-hmm.
James Langston Hughes wrote Backlash Blues for her. And James Baldwin, Miriam Makeba, Stokely Carmichael. This was her community in the mid-60s. So this song marked the beginning of that journey for Nina, which really turned her into this patron saint of the rebellion.
Salamisha Tillett joins us in just a moment. A call first from Gene in Middletown, Connecticut. Gene, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I just hope that in this documentary they show the power as a performer. I was at a Newport. As you know, the Newport Jazz and Folks had
yes.
a mixture of people. Nina Simone came on after a horrendous thunderstorm. When she hit the stage, you could have heard a pin drop at Newport. I have followed her for the last, I'm 69 years old. I think I dropped my Beatles records for Nina Simone. Her concert pianist, which all she liked to people to be quiet during her concerts. I've seen her at Carnegie Hall. She gave a Mother's Day concert there. That classical pianist never left her, that training. And the and just before I leave, I'm just so excited because when I meet somebody that doesn't know Nina Simone, I think what rock they live under. There's a biography that was written about her called "I Put a Spell on You."
Yes, her autobiography, co-written, but her own, yes.
Yes, yes, which is wonderful. And I thank you again, Tom, for bringing this to and the your documentary film.
You're very welcome, Gene. It's her time again somehow. Let me get one more right here, if I may. Andy in Paint Lick, Kentucky. Andy, you're on.
Yes, hi. I'm really glad to hear this show. I was a an assistant, actually, audio, and I worked on the Steve Allen Show in 1969.
Okay.
I didn't know who Nina Simone was, but I had to work with her, give her a microphone and all of that. And I was just impressed with her presence before she even sang a song. She was an impressive, I mean, I just felt an aura off her. She was a significant person.
Describe that, Andy. What was that aura, that presence? Describe it for us. You were right there.
Ah, boy, I don't know. She just had she commanded respect. I don't know. She just was a proud and strong woman, and it was really obvious. Before I even heard her sing, I didn't know who she was. And then she sang "I Love You, Porgy," and I knew of that song, and I was just very much impressed with her. And my question would be, she came onto that show, Steve Allen. Now, Steve Allen put a lot of people on the show mm-hmm. that he had control of that didn't necessarily make it onto national television very often,
mm-hmm.
i.e. Pete Seeger got mm-hmm. back onto national television to a good deal due to Steve Allen.
A little politically edgy people you're suggesting there.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if Nina Simone, I think I know the answer, had a lot of trouble dealing with racism and bigotry that didn't allow her to have a presence on national television.
Liz, do you want to speak to that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I've seen that Steve Allen show, the show that you worked on there, and her performance of Porgy on Steve Allen, which was just spellbinding. And she also talks on the show about writing Mississippi Goddamn. It might have been a later visit. And we include a clip of that, her explanation of writing that song on the Steve Allen show. And she, you know, she was just so direct. And yes, once Nina became politicized and she started doing the civil rights music, she did feel that the industry punished her. And there's actually a quote from her husband, who was also her manager, in our film, where he says that she looked at the Aretha Franklins and the Gladys Knights, who were doing the nighttime television shows, and that she wasn't getting those gigs, and that she bemoaned that. But at the same time, it was clear that she had chosen a path which would preclude her from getting that kind of commercial success.
I mean, she called herself more or less blackballed at one point in your documentary. Here's a little clip from What Happened, Miss Simone, where Nina Simone talks about her courage, despite all, to be herself.
I really mean to provoke this feeling of like, who am I? Where did I come from? You know, do I really like me? And why do I like me? Like, you know, if I am black and beautiful, I really am, and I know it, and I don't care who cares, says what.
I got my hair, got my hair, got my brains, got my ears, got my eyes, got my nose, got my mouth, I got myself.
Nina Simone in the new documentary, What Happened, Miss Simone. Watson in Hacienda Heights, California. Watson, you're on.
Thanks for taking the call.
Yes.
Yeah, I believe that her anger was, I mean, it was justified for the reality she was living, but her fight was based in hope, not in anger. You know?
What's the evidence? What's the evidence to you, Watson?
How about just one song, the cover from the Beatles, Here Comes the Sun?
Yeah. Let me pick that up, if I may, Watson. Thank you for your call from California. I want to bring in Salamisha Tillett. She joins us from Newark, New Jersey, professor of English at the University of Pennsylvania, has taught Nina Simone there. She's in the Department of Africana Studies, Gender, Sexuality, Women's Studies, author of Sites of Slavery. Salamisha Tillett, it's an honor to have you with us. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You've written so wonderfully about Nina Simone recently, partly in response to Liz Garbus's documentary, but then there's a lot going on with Nina Simone. The headline on your own piece recently in the Times was, Nina Simone's time is now, again. Why, Salamisha?
Well, I mean, I think you've spoken to why this year in particular, I think, is a moment in which we need Nina Simone's voice, given all of the kind of racial turmoil that we've been experiencing as a nation and African-Americans in particular. So I think there's an obvious space for Nina Simone. But I've really been tracking Nina Simone's like return, as I see it, over the last decade. And so there are a number of factors that I think create the possibility and the need for an artist like Nina Simone to return. One, I think actually has a lot to do with like sound technology. So people being able to go on YouTube and watch concert clips of her. She was such an energetic and complicated live performer. But actually, I think record companies at the time and audiences often understood that that was her best space because she could improvise and play with genres in one song or throughout the entire set. So I think people being able to see her, who didn't necessarily grow up listening to her. Also, there's just an unbelievable amount of musical material on things like iTunes to download. So I think it's just, as we see those sound technologies being created in the early 2000s, it was also a moment that people could rediscover Nina Simone for themselves. And then you have artists who go from being kind of, you know, indie artists to becoming completely mainstream, like Kanye West sampling her repeatedly on many of his albums. And he hasn't officially spoken about why he uses Nina Simone, but you can see it as part of his soul aesthetic, making Nina Simone relevant or accessible or available to a new generation of listeners. So I think there are a number of factors that are technological, that are musical, and that are cultural, and now political, that make Nina Simone possible for us in a new way.
Does a moment of maybe disenchantment with a country's progress or lack thereof on race put her front and center again?
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that Nina Simone embodies both, like as Liz said earlier, a rage and a discontentment that we see that is part of the 60s narrative, as well as a deep desire for social change and love. So love and rage, I think, are throughout her entire body of work, but that she gets to it in a way that maybe so few artists can really make us understand and make us hear as clearly. So I think, yeah, I mean, I think this decade has been defined by both a deep desire for racial and social transformation through the election of the first African-American president, Barack Obama, but also the aftermath of that has created an understanding of the ways in which structural racism continues to haunt the nation and define our daily existence, as well as, you know, what comes after hope? Is it disillusionment? Mm-hmm. Is it a desire to create maybe a more democratic possibility? Is it rage? I mean, all of these things, all of these contradictions and complexities are very American, but they're also where we are right now. And I think, you know, how do we get through that? And we turn to people like Nina Simone to help us have the vocabulary and the music and the art to get us through and help us wake up in the morning.
Let's listen to Madame Simone herself maybe on that front. This is Backlash Blues. It was written by her good friend Langston Hughes, the lyrics here, originally on her Nina Simone Sings the Blues album from 1967, Backlash Blues.
You give me second-class houses and second-class schools. Do you think that all colored folks are just second-class fools? Mr. Backlash, I'm gonna leave you with a backlash blues.
beige and brown, Mr. Backlash. I'm gonna leave you with a backlash blue.
Nina Simone in 1967, Backlash Blues. Steve in Miami, Florida. Thank you for calling, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you today?
Okay, what are you here?
Yeah, I'm just, I want to make a comment on Nina Simone. First of all, I love her music, and it is an outlet for a lot of people. What she went through is what I see in my community, that a lot of people are going through, and they really have no outlet as far as the mental problems and anguish. When you're on a certain level in society, you know, it's pretty much prominent, and I'm seeing it all across the board in my community.
And do you mean on a low rung of the ladder?
Is that exactly
what you, with all the stresses that come with that, and with the color issues you find there?
Yeah, pretty much. I listen in my community when people talk, and it's there. So what she's saying, Nina Simone, and her music, it reflects a lot in the African American community.
Salamisha, Steve calls in and says, "Look, if she was disturbed sometimes, that doesn't look like strange territory to him, given what he sees and lives through, and many around him."
Yeah, and actually, that's one of the my favorite parts of Liz's film is when Ambassador Shabazz talks about, you know, on one hand, obviously Nina Simone suffered from a mental illness that gets diagnosed and treated quite well, I think, in the film and by a number of Nina Simone's relatives and friends. But I also think, you know, what does it mean to grow up as a child prodigy, in a black child prodigy in a racist town? What does it mean to go to Philadelphia, which is seen as a symbol of like freedom and independence, and then get rejected from the Curtis Institute, and then come of age professionally in this moment of deep racial turmoil and antagonism, and then have her years after her 70s really be blackballed, as we talked about earlier? Mm-hmm. The protest years were over for her and for many musicians and artists, even though it created a possibility for people like James Brown and Aretha Franklin to have a kind of black consciousness musical practice and lyrics. Artists like Nina Simone, who were explicitly talking about racism, really weren't in favor. So it you know, what happens if you already have a kind of a mental illness and then tied to American racism and American sexism? It creates a very, very, very jaded and also deeply disappointed figure who really feels like she never got her due. And so I guess that's another part of, I guess, Liz's film, but also this return to Nina that I'm interested in is, you know, what does it mean to have this kind of prophet-like figure who's gone recognized by some, but not nearly as recognized as she should be in the icon, the pantheon of American great artists, finally get her due, even if it's belated and posthumous. And so, you know, living with that, I think, haunted Nina Simone for all of her life. And now we're here, so hopefully she can appreciate it.
We've got more to look at. The director of the new documentary, What Happened, Miss Simone, Liz Garbus, is with us from New York. Salamisha Tillett is with us from the University of Pennsylvania. You can join us as well. Behind us right here, Old Jim Crow, 1964. Old Jim Crow, What's Wrong With You, Nina Simone sings. What's your question on Nina Simone? Do we need her? Need to listen to her now? Her energy? Her anger? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
It's all over now, it's all over now. Oh, Jim Crow, you know it's true. When you hurt my brother, you hurt me too. Oh, Jim Crow, don't you know it's all over now, yeah. Oh, Jim Crow, thought I had to be.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
She lime, she drink coffee. Drink tea and then go home.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the artistry and the anger of Nina Simone, icon of the civil rights era and beyond, who stood up angrily, beautifully for black Americans. She's the subject of a new documentary out from Netflix called What Happened, Miss Simone? From some writing from Maya Angelou, that phrase. Liz Garbus is the director. She joins us today from New York. Salamisha Tillett is with us as well from Newark, New Jersey. Professor of English in the Africana Studies and Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies departments at the University of Pennsylvania. You can join us this hour. Did Nina Simone back in the day give voice to your dismay, your anger? Does she still? What's your question on her? Do we need her now? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Sea Lion Woman here from 1964, her adaptation of a traditional American folk song. We go to Gray in Florence, South Carolina. Gray, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I was calling. I heard you ask a couple of times, do we need her? You know, how does she affect? I'm in my 40s from Seattle, Washington, so I kind of understand that where you grew up in this kind of world that's a little bit more sheltered than the average, maybe African-American, but the what she's able to do is she's able to express that anger and that angst you feel when you just kind of feel marginalized. And, you know, as in the last 40 years since civil rights movement, 50 years, it's been really candy coated and brushed over. No one wants to talk about it. You can't talk about it. You want to be that person who gets a job or who's accepted or who fits in as an African-American woman, especially. You can't talk about it really, or you make everybody uncomfortable. And even now she's able to express it emotionally and through music in a way that speaks to how maybe I feel every day, but I don't want to rock the boat. And she rocks it for me. And there's no one today can express it the way that she can express it and get the validity and the weight behind it that she still can do. And so I think that's what's so special about her, is that she still has that, she's still that mouthpiece for that feeling that we have. And even more so now because we can't talk about it. I mean, this thing happened in Charleston, and it's like, oh, wow, look what happened in Charleston. This stuff is happening all the time, every day. You hear it all the time, and nobody wants to talk about it until 9 people lost their lives to someone.
Yes.
But that didn't just happen. That's been happening forever. So she's our mouthpiece right now.
Gray, I'm so glad for your call. Thank you very much for it. Salamisha, speak to that observation, if you will, and this peculiarity that you would think we would be more free by now, that all people would be more free to speak their mind. Certainly by now you think African-American people, women would be more free, and yet there's Gray today as we speak in South Carolina saying she needs someone, Nina Simone, from decades ago, much of what we're hearing today, to come and express it in 2015.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of one of the outcomes of the gains of the civil rights movement, and a narrative that it was completely successful has created an atmosphere, and not just the civil rights movement, but the feminist movement as well, that it's created an atmosphere or climate in which people really don't know how to talk about structural inequality, right? So if you don't have Jim Crow as an institutional presence, then how do we talk about the everyday experiences of racism and sexism and homophobia that most Americans are privy to? And so I think when we have an artist like Nina Simone who so explicitly talks about it, it feels like a breath of fresh air, but it also gives us a vocabulary that we think we don't have right now. I mean, I do think that there are artists that have been speaking truth to power, that mm-hmm. have been wrestling with questions of authority and both state power and then kind of, everyday racism and sexism in their music. What is true, though, is that it is very hard for that kind of artist to achieve the kind of commercial success that pop artists are striving for today. And Nina Simone, and this is kind of the ambivalence, she was highly celebrated and well regarded during her time. But she had her own anxieties around not being as famous or successful as a group like the Beatles, for example. In one of her diaries, she talks about this new group, the Beatles, having the opportunity to refine their music and their sound and their style. And she also wanted that chance but didn't have it, right? So she kind of came of age in the civil rights movement, but never was seen as a kind of crossover artist, despite the fact that she had a deeply multiracial fan base. So I think Nina Simone understood it in her time, but I also think that we don't reward artists enough for taking these kind of intellectual and artistic risk. I think we crave it. But one thing that was interesting is when I interviewed John Legend, he felt like it's not the end of the world. He says it's not career suicide to take these political risks. It's just that most artists aren't encouraged to do it and also aren't in a community that supports them, meaning that they're not in a fan, they don't have the fan base to support them, but they may not actually be an artistic community that supports them. Nina Simone's political coming of age was prompted by her relationship with Lorraine Hansberry, who told Nina Simone, "I'm happy you're performing at Carnegie Hall, but Martin Luther King's locked up right now. What are you doing for the people?" I mean, what do artists today who are in the mainstream have their fellow peers chiding them and encouraging them to take intellectual and artistic risk? I'm not sure. So it's a number of reasons why I think it's difficult for artists who are mainstream to take these risks. But indie artists are doing it. They're constantly doing it. And they're the primary ones who invoke Nina Simone as well.
Yeah. I mean, Lorraine Hansberry, of course, who wrote Raisin in the Sun. Nina Simone, who said to Dr. King, "Look, I'm not about nonviolence." And you quote Gina Prince Bythewood saying that Simone is more than an alternative. But nevertheless, today's image of the over-sexualized or over-manufactured female artist, those very big. Liz Garbus, it's true. I mean, John Legend may say, yes, you can be political, but there are very few who would take it where Nina Simone took it. You've got this footage in the film where I think she's in Harlem and she's talking to a big crowd, African-American largely crowd, and she's asking, "Are you ready to smash white things, to burn buildings? Are you ready to kill if necessary?" Now, I think she's reading someone's poem there, but nevertheless, she is voicing it quite vividly. She took it right out there and felt later in her years of, self-exile in Africa and Europe that she was paying the price for that.
Oh, indeed, yeah, and she was. I mean, her career was stifled from a commercial point of view because of those positions, and you know, she wasn't getting the same bookings that she would have, or that some of her peers were getting, her colleagues. I mean, she said that, you know, her words were, the music industry punished her for her civil rights music and for her involvement. That's undeniable.
Here she is talking about moments when she felt free and saying that to her it meant an absence of fear. To Gray's call from South Carolina, this is from an interview, part of which is used in Liz Garbus's new documentary, What Happened, Miss Simone.
I've had a couple of times on stage when I really felt free, and that's something else. That's really something else. Like I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear. If I could have that half of my life, no fear. Lots of children have no fear. That's the closest way, that's the only way I can describe it. That's not all of it, but it is something to really, really feel.
Nina Simone, speaking of freedom and fear, here from 1964, her song Images, singing about black women's beauty. Nina Simone.
She does not know her beauty. She thinks her brown glory. She thinks her brown body has no glory.
Nina Simone, 1964. Penelope, Lauderdale Lakes, Florida. Penelope, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really, really appreciate you, Tom. This is just a blessing in disguise. I really love hearing everything. I want to ditto everyone that has called in and had an opportunity. I'm talking fast because I have so
good.
Much. I'll try to make.
Go.
To because I've had a personal experience with her, beautiful experiences with her. I'm a retired teacher here in Florida, but when I lived in New York and teaching, I was accepted in an international teacher's exchange program to teach in Africa. And Nina Simone was, she actually, when she heard about the program, she was so overwhelmed that she herself did not have an opportunity to go, that she offered to do at least a benefit for us. And it was at the Beacon Theater in New York. And beautiful. It was just as the lady said before, when she walked on the stage, the place was so packed. At that time, during that year, that generation, it was, yes, you could stand outside, but there were no microphones or anything like that. But it was packed. And she went to the piano, and she sat down. And when she sat down, she looked around, and, you know, examining the piano, we were thinking. But at the time, she looked, and we waited and waited. And, you know, when you're on the stage, two or 3 minutes is a long time.
Yes, it is.
About 4 or 5 minutes. And so we were beginning to wonder. But then finally, someone walked on stage, handed her an envelope. She sat there, and she opened it up. And then she, you know, set it, put it next to her on the bench, and then she began playing. Now, what had happened was, unfortunately, that agency, and this is another thing I wanted to mention, that agency people have always, all throughout her life, as you had so eloquently, or the young lady had spoke before, so eloquently, people have taken advantage of her, and she was willing to play at that time, but they did not pay her in advance.
So she was waiting for her pay to begin to play.
There you go. Exactly.
She would sit there as long as it took, never mind the discomfort in the hall.
That's right. Wow. And so I imagine they were collecting the money from the door or whatever, however they were able to. But she kept her promise.
Penelope, that's a great anecdote, and our time grows short. I so appreciate your calling in with it. I want to share it with my guest, Liz Garbus. Remind us, and you've got this in the show, I mean, that was probably not the lowest point. There she was just waiting. But in Africa, things got really bad. And in Europe, things got even worse. Describe when it got so low, what was going on with her, her ex-husband, her daughter?
Well, there were a lot of things going on. I mean, after she left the U.S., she left her husband. She went to Barbados and then to Liberia, which was a country she wanted, you know, she said was the right place for her because it was a place that had been founded by freed slaves. Ultimately, she wasn't playing music there and she was very happy. But you know, the money, again, ran out. She wasn't getting gigs. And so she went to Switzerland and played the Montreux Jazz Festival. And there's a clip of that we use in the film that, you know, reminds people of the kind of performance style that Nina Simone had, which was, you know, again, she expected the audience to be quiet and listen the way they would in a classical hall. And that was part of her performance. That was part of her theater. It was part of her power, part of her control. I mean, the story about her demanding to be paid before she played is not surprising at all. I mean, she had been so ripped off throughout her entire life, and she was trying to come up with ways to support herself and to change the dynamic. She was very, very strong, you know, this was how she knew she could wait and she would get paid. So, you know, there were stories about her going into meetings with, you know, with a knife available to her, so if she wasn't going to get her payment, get her contract lived up to. So, you know, all of these things, you know, this was her trying to take control of an oppressive power dynamic.
Here she is, 1970, with To Be Young, Gifted in Black from the album Black Gold.
Young, gifted in black.
Oh, what a lovely, precious dream.
Sound right there. Of course, that phrase from her good friend Lorraine Hansberry of Raisin in the Sun, playwright Ping in Detroit. You're our last caller, Ping. What do you see?
Hi, thanks for picking my call.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Liz, for this wonderful, wonderful documentary. We appreciate it. I am an actor and a vocalist. Shirley and Ping and Shirley Facebook page. We actually do a Nina Simone show. We've been doing it here in Detroit for years, and we continue on with the legendary music, a wonderful attitude, and we are in strong, strong affirmation that Nina's music will go on forever.
Ping, keep it going, and thank you for your call today. Salamisha Tillett, what's most important to remember to meditate on about Nina Simone right now?
I actually think it's what we would say in academia with Kim Crenshaw, her intersectionality. So it's not just that she foregrounded race, but that she was really foregrounding a kind of Black feminism that we see in the song like Images and Four Women, and also resonates with a friendship like Lorraine Hansberry. Mm-hmm. And so I think of the Black Lives Matter movement, obviously it's about racial injustice, but it comes from the minds of three Black queer women who are really trying to challenge a static notion of what Black identity is. It's including trans people, it's including queer people, and foregrounding women. And so I think that's the takeaway that I would like to, that's why she's prophetic, because she was doing all of that at the time. It wasn't only about racial injustice, but about racial injustice tied to women's progress. And so I just think that's where we are right now.
And Liz, last word goes to you. What do you hope people take away from your telling of her life story, your documentary?
Oh, I think, you know, she's an inspiration. She's a way forward right now through all of this. And also that, you know, they'll come back and listen to her music with a profound sense of understanding.
Hear the strength, hear the courage of Nina Simone. Liz Garbus is director of the new Netflix documentary, What Happened, Miss Simone. She's joined us today from New York. Liz, good luck with it. Thank you very much. Congratulations on having it out.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And Salamisha Tillett at the University of Pennsylvania in the Department of Africana Studies there. Salamisha Tillett, Professor Tillett, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
We go out with I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free, 1967, Silken Soul, Nina Simone, her version of the old gospel song, Civil Rights Anthem. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
All the bars that keep us apart, I wish you could know what it means.